This is an important lecture today. I'm going to be talking about the Congress of Vienna, really about the Vienna system. It's often called the Concert of Europe. This is the system that was hammered out by the representatives of the great powers in a very important meeting that took place in the Austrian capital of Vienna. It lasted a very long time. It began in 1814 and only concluded in 1815. Why is this issue important? Because it bears very directly on the fundamental issue that we're concerned with, not just in this class, but in the study of international relations more generally, which is to say, the issue of war and peace. You know the focus of this class. The second part of the final exam, the take-home part of the final exam, is focused on this particular question. There's a theory about what makes for war and peace. The theory is you don't need aggressors to have war. You know, the problem is built into the very structure of international politics. The anarchic structure of international politics, as I say, anarchy is a term of art. It means in this literature simply the absence of overarching authority. Right? It's a set of sovereign independent states. In such a world, the argument runs, conflict is unavoidable. Really, war is unavoidable. And one of the foremost proponents of this view is the very eminent international relations theorist Kenneth Waltz. You're reading an article of his this week in which he makes this kind of argument. And his book, most famous book called Theory of International Politics, I think it's considered one of the most important works ever written, theoretical nature on international affairs. A lot of people think it's the most important book that's come out, certainly in the United States, in the last 100 years on this subject. And Waltz makes this argument. Where do you find it? In that article that you read, or you're supposed to read for this week, on page 619, 620. He says, from the vantage point of neorealist theory, which is his theory, he says, competition and conflict among states stem directly from the twin facts of life under conditions of anarchy. States in an anarchic order must provide for their own security, and threats or seeming threats to their security abound. Preoccupation with identifying dangers and counteracting them become a way of life. Relations remain tense. The actors are usually suspicious and often hostile, even though by nature they may not be given to suspicion hostility. It's a very typical argument of his. He's basically saying, it's not your nature, it's not your inherent character that determines your behavior. Your behavior is shaped in a very profound way by the environment in which you find yourself, by the structure of the system. This theory is often called structural realism, systemic realism. Individually, states may only be doing what they can to bolster their security. Their individual intentions aside, collectively, their actions yield arms, races, and alliances. This uneasy state of affairs is exacerbated by the familiar security dilemma, wherein measures that enhance one state's security typically diminish that of others. In an anarchic domain, the source of one's own comfort is the source of another's worry. Hence, a state that is amassing instruments of war, even for its own defense, is cast by others as a threat requiring response. You see, and the system kind of pushes states into conflict with each other. The response itself then serves to confirm the first state's belief that it had reason to worry. Similarly, an alliance that in the interest of defense moves to increase cohesion among its members and add to its ranks inadvertently imperils an opposing alliance and provokes countermeasures. Then it goes on, he says, well, some states may hunger for power's sake. And here he's alluding to a famous theorist of the early post-World War II period, Hans Morgenthau, who did make exactly that argument. And Wolff says he's going beyond Morgenthau because he doesn't posit that hunger for power's sake, that desire to assert oneself as a kind of end in itself. He says, no, you don't need anything like that. The countries may not have any such urge, but they're forced to behave that way by the logic of the system. It says, neorealist theory, however, shows that it is not necessary to assume an innate lust for power in order to account for the sometimes fierce competition that marks the international arena. In an anarchic domain, a state of war exists if all parties lust for power, but so too will a state of war exist if all states seek only to ensure their own safety. Right? And he goes on, he says, neorealist theory does not explain why particular wars are fought, but it does explain war's dismal recurrence through the millennia. That's the taproot. That explains why you have war, not just in any particular period, but for thousands of years. Right? It's not because of aggression or evil or anything like that. These states are trapped by the system in which they find themselves, by the anarchic system, anarchic structure of international politics. Right? So your job, in a sense, the goal in the course of this quarter, is to hold that philosophy up to the light and say, is that true? Is this the key to the whole problem of war and peace? Now, what's fascinating here is normally you think in the scholarly world you have, people taking sides and the people who believe this argument and people who kind of criticize this argument, and so you'd want to weigh arguments. But that's not true in this particular case, because the two great schools, the interpretation of international relations, the realists and the liberals, they both buy into that basic diagnosis. They both think that the system is to blame. They both point the finger at the anarchic structure of international politics when they're trying to explain why you have wars. So what's the difference between the two? The difference is that the differences emerge when you come to the question of, okay, that's the case. What can you do about it? And the liberals tend to be optimistic. The realists tend to be pessimistic. The liberals would say, if the system is to blame, we've got to change the system. We've got to get away from the system based on power. If we can't quite have a world state, we should try and move in that direction through international organization, through the rule of law, through kind of softening the hard edges of the anarchic system. Right? Say, you could if we did this sort of thing, built up the United Nations, and promoted the rule of law and change the character, the internal character of states, make them more liberal, more democratic, and so on. We wouldn't have to worry so much about that logic. Right? And the realists, they basically say, that's just pie in the sky. If anything, those attempts probably do more harm than good. We're trapped. Right? Nothing much we could do about it. At least let's understand it so that when we're trying to figure out how our own country should behave, it understands what the game is all about, so it could frame its policy accordingly. And so, if you're interested in this general set of problems, you have to ask yourself, are those the only two possible approaches? Only two possible ways of getting at the problem. Realists and the liberals. Is it obvious that the whole diagnosis that the system is to blame, that the anarchic structure of international politics is the taproot, the root cause of all of our problems? is it obvious that that diagnosis is in fact correct? And the whole point of the lecture today is, wait a second, there's a third way. There's a third approach to this whole set of issues. Third tradition of dealing with international policies. Appeals to kind of statesmen of a more conservative bent. So call it the kind of conservative approach to international order. We'll see it in practice in the Vienna system, the policies pursued at the Congress of Vienna and in the post-Vienna period, essentially the first half of the 19th century, 1815 to 1848. Okay. But this approach that I'll be talking about in a few minutes, it didn't just kind of come out of nowhere. It wasn't something that just kind of occurred to the statesmen meeting at Vienna. They were building on an intellectual tradition that had flowered in the 18th century, the 18th century balance of power tradition. Right? I put down the names there of four of the leading theorists. Two of them, Hume and Rousseau, you've probably heard of, but Fenelon and Vattel were actually probably more important in the development of this way of looking at things. This is an approach which places great emphasis on what's called the balance of power. Now, balance of power is a very tricky term. It has all kinds of different meanings. But here the idea is states should not just look out after their own national interests, their own parochial interests, their own selfish interests. They should also conduct their policy with an eye to what's in the interests of the system as a whole. Right? The European system, the European political system, great power political system in Europe. The idea is that the European states form, and these are phrases from this 18th century literature, form a kind of society, a sort of republic. They have interests in common. And one has to pursue a policy with an eye to those common interests. If you push too hard in pressing your own national interests, that sort of strategy is likely to be counterproductive. Because the other states in Europe will gang up against you. Look at what happened with Napoleon. You have to pull in your horns. It doesn't make sense to kind of try and go too far, according to this way of looking at these things. If you get involved in a war, and this is right from Fenelon, if you're even in a peacetime situation, you shouldn't raise up your ally too high or push your adversary down too low, because you need that element of balance. That you need your adversary as a counterweight to your present-day ally. Let me kind of give you a feel for how important this way of looking at things is. Let's fast forward to kind of the end of the course. I'll talk about the First World War and the policy of Britain and France in the First World War. The war's a stalemate, right? And yet their goal in the war is to pursue their policy to the bitter end, to absolutely crush Germany, to defeat Germany. Right? Fenelon would have looked at this and said, this is kind of crazy. Suppose the Entente powers had won in the First World War, let's say France, Britain, and Russia, and won, Germany was absolutely crushed. Well, from the point of view of France and Britain, that would simply create a new problem, this enormous Russian power in the East. You would want a relatively strong Germany as a counterweight to Russia, as a balance to Russia, so that both the Germans and the Russians, balancing each other off, would have an interest in good relations with you. You would want a balance. You would want an equilibrium. See? And it was the failure to think in those terms, to reach for, you know, total victory, total crushing of the adversary, rather than for, you know, more moderate goals, a compromise, peace, you know. You'd say, well, that was a very fundamental problem. It's because people weren't in touch with this powerful intellectual tradition. It's a view that said, well, states are members of a society. They have interest in the stability of that political order. They have an interest in a political order which guarantees to them their own independence, their own liberty, as people said. Equilibrium is what you have to reach. Because a balance of power restrains everybody. Right? And it's in the interest of the system as a whole, the interest of Europe as a whole. Right? And of course, the concern with internal revolution was an important factor here. But this is a philosophy that did not really depend in any fundamental way on the threat of internal revolution. And that sort of thinking, very powerful tradition in the 18th century, clearly influenced the peacemakers at Vienna in Vienna Napoleonic period. Metternich, who was one of the dominant figures at Vienna, the Austrian statesman, he studied with one of these theorists, someone who wrote a major book on the balance of power. So these notions of balance of power, equilibrium, limited goals, the need to take into account the interests of the system as a whole, Europe as a whole, the need for legitimacy, the need to reintegrate everybody so that everyone played an important role in the system. These were major ideas at the end. That's the theory. What did it mean in practice? How did it translate into a political system? What was the Vienna system? Part of it certainly had to do with the way the defeated great power was dealt with, France. Major part. And in fact, there were two peace settlements with France, one in 1814, and then a second after Napoleon came back and he raised an army and challenged the victorious powers again. It was finally defeated at Waterloo. There was a second and final peace settlement with France. But those two settlements, especially the first, but even the second one, in France, was treated slightly more harshly, were very mild, very mild. France lost very little in terms of the gain she had made. This was not even an attempt to kind of turn back the clock to France's borders in 1780. One of the things you should do is go into that website. I gave the link in the syllabus, the Maps and Tables website, and look at the maps there. Compare the maps. The map of Europe in 1789 with Europe in 1815. The map, I think it's map 11, that shows you what France's territorial losses were. Very mild. No crushing reparations, no forcing of the French to accept war guilt or anything like that. The sorts of things we were going to have a century later in the Treaty of Versailles itself in the First World War. Nothing like that. So why? Why was France treated in such a mild way? Because you want the French not to rebel against the system. You want to give the French a stake in the stability of the system, a belief in the legitimacy of the system. And why do you want that? Because it's just, you just want to be nice to countries as a kind of end in itself? No, it had to do with French power. Not only do you want France not to rebel, but you want France to be one of the pillars of the status quo, because you're worried about other countries. For example, the Austrians, the British, they're worried about Russia becoming too strong. It's enormous Russian power. And so you would want France to kind of be a pillar of the status quo so that, in theory, French power could be brought into play against Russia, which in fact happened during a, you know, during the Congress of Vienna itself, when there was a whole dispute about how much territory Russia would get at the end of the war. Because Russia, in the course of the 18th century, had been steadily expanding toward the west. Now, Russia wanted to kind of basically take over practically all of what's now Poland. Poland, important parts of Poland had been part of Prussia. Prussia was not a fully German state at that point. A very substantial part of Prussian territory was Polish. In fact, the city of Warsaw, the main city in Poland, had been part of Prussia before. Now, the Russians won, and the Russians got the support of the Prussians by promising to support Prussian territorial demands within Germany, the defense of Saxony, and so on. This led to this crisis. Right? Austrians, British didn't want Russia to become too strong. They thought that both Russia and Prussia were going too far. And they actually made an alliance. Britain and Western made an alliance with France so that French power could be thrown into the scales on the side of limiting Russian gains, keeping Russia from going too far. You see the symbolism of it, the larger implications. Limits to Russian power. France plays a role. France plays a role in the equilibrium. And for that to happen, you had to kind of reintegrate France into the European system by treating France gently. But there was a whole lot more to the Vienna system than that. In fact, these treaties with France were made outside of Vienna. And they were interested not just in figuring out a way to deal with France, but also a way to kind of create a stable international order in Europe as a whole. They were thinking in systems terms. How can you create a stable structure of power in Europe? Because stable system meant equilibrium, balance of power. Right? They're building on that early body of thought. Well, what did they do? You had to worry about France. Simply dealing gently with France wasn't the end of the story. There had to be counterweights to French power, because the whole Napoleonic experience had shown you how powerful this country was inherently. What did you have to do? Well, the basic idea was that the powers that had defeated France would kind of stay together and subordinate their own internal conflicts to the goal of maintaining their unity so as to create a limit to what France could do. But it went beyond that, because there were barriers constructed to French expansion both in the north and in the south. In the north, the Low Countries were united into the United Kingdom of the Netherlands. Right? Belgium, now Belgium, wasn't a state in those days, and Holland were amalgamated into a single, you know, mid-level state, right? And backing up that state there in the north was a strengthened Prussia that was in effect moved to the west. What do we mean by that? Moved to the west? That in exchange for withdrawing from the east, from large parts of Poland, which were then handed over to Russia, Poland got all this territory in the west of Germany, right? It's kind of light blue here on this map. Those are the territories that now went to Prussia. Prussia became a much more western-oriented state. Again, a further creation of a massive power in France's north to limit what France could do. Right? This is a powerful source for the containment of France in the north. The same sort of thing in the south. The small Italian kingdom of Sardinia. And of course, you know, you can see from the map that Germany and Italy are by no means united at this point. The small Italian kingdom of what was called Sardinia was expanded, at the expense of you know, ancient political entities like the Republic of Genoa. And this strengthened Italian kingdom on France's southeastern border was backed up by an expansion of Austrian power in the direction of Italy, where a lot of the Italian states were either dominated or closely aligned with Austria. I made that point about Genoa because it's often argued or often believed that the whole goal of the Vienna settlement was to turn the clock back. It's a famous book about the Congress of Vienna by Henry Kissinger, you may have heard of, called The World Restored. Just think about what that title implies, a world restored. But they're not trying to turn the clock back and restore the political system to what it had been in 1789. They're creating something rather new based on a rather different set of principles, right? It's oriented toward the future, not toward the past, toward creating a stable structure of power, not validating principles of legitimacy or whatever. Okay? Now, there's more to the system. Because within Germany, a new political structure is created called the German Confederation, which is dominated by the two main German states, Austria and Prussia, but including all the other states, the smaller and mid-ranking states, Bavaria, Baden-Württemberg, and so on. And the German Confederation was essentially a defensive alliance, which also had certain internal lawmaking abilities. And the whole idea here was once again, instead of having Austria and Prussia as rivals for dominance in Germany, which you're going to have later in the century, they're agreeing to cooperate, to share the control of Germany, and they'll cooperate in particular in pursuing a defense-oriented policy, aimed at keeping other powers, namely France and Russia, at bay. It's too loose, too weak to serve as an instrument for an offense. Oriented, an aggressive sort of policy, but it's strong enough to kind of serve as a counterweight to the offensive goals of other countries. You can see how all these different aspects of the system fall into a pattern. The goal is a certain structure of power, balance of power. Everyone is kept in check. Russia is kept in check. France is kept in check. Right? Austria's goals, Germany's goals are limited and so on. Okay. I'll come to this point in a second. But I don't want you to come away thinking that it's simply
a mechanical system. That once the system is in place, stability is automatic, end of the story. The viability of this kind of system is not guaranteed simply by these texts and these border changes and so on. It depends in very large measure on the nature of the policies that these different countries pursue. Policies directed at the maintenance of the status quo. Here you have Austria. Austria is a multi-ethnic state. It is not interested in radical change in the status quo. Doesn't even really want to gain more territory. Right? It has its own internal multi-ethnic political balance to worry about. Right? So Austria is basically going to be a conservative power. And what that means is not simply that Austria's political weight is going to be thrown into the balance on behalf of maintaining the status quo. It also means that other powers that are interested in maintaining the status quo and are interested in maintaining the present political balance in Europe are going to support Austria. So they're going to throw their own political weight into the balance on Austria's side. Okay. Who are those other powers? Of those other powers, the most important is Britain. And British policy is quite remarkable in this period. It's basically shaped by the British Foreign Secretary, Lord Castlereagh, who worked very closely with Metternich at the Sevilla. And it would have been very easy for Britain to kind of turn her back on Europe. Let the Europeans solve their problems themselves. Britain is very secure now. The Industrial Revolution is running its course. It's focused primarily in Britain. Britain has this very powerful navy. Britain is secure from the continent. But that's not Castlereagh's view. Castlereagh's argument, you'll see in that letter he wrote to the British ambassador in Berlin. That's one of the readings for this week, which he lays out his basic thinking. Britain is really very strong, very secure now. But instead of using that as a reason for kind of pulling out of Europe, it meant that Britain could afford to pursue a generous, a moderate policy, policy not based on the pursuit of its own, you know, selfish national goals. Again, you know, at the Congress of Vienna, British naval power could have been used to kind of scoop up the overseas possessions of any other country that British wanted, above all France. They didn't do that, because they bored into this whole notion of why we need the sort of settlement the other powers were trying to reach. Right? British influence would be thrown into the balance on the side of moderation, on the side of getting all the other countries to work with each other. Right? Very important. Russian policy, Tsar Alexander, the basic maker of Russian policy, he agreed with all this stuff. Russia also should pull in her horns. Russia also should try and work within the European balance. It would be a mistake to push Russian power too far. It would be a mistake to allow these antagonisms of the other great powers of Europe to get out of hand. It's that kind of spirit that lies at the heart of the Vienna settlement. And Castlereagh says, well, I don't know if it's going to last forever, but let's try and keep it intact as long as we can. All right. And I should say, those aspects of the settlement, the kind of wish to kind of work together, to kind of cooperate with each other to the extent possible, is reflected in another aspect of the agreements that were reached in Vienna at that time. And this was the whole idea that the great powers would meet together in congresses. The Congress of Vienna was the first. There were others at Verona and at Laibach and so on, Aix-la-Chapelle. In the post-Vienna period, The whole idea was you would establish a kind of semi-official organization to oversee the affairs of Europe. This is like the antecedent of the Council of the League of Nations or the Security Council of the United Nations. That sort of philosophy. The great powers working together as a bloc in the interests of Europe as a whole. Metternich said, for me, Europe has the quality of a fatherland. Right? Very revealing comment. And it's to be contrasted with the attitude that you find in the second half of the 19th century associated with Bismarck, which is just very cynical. You know, Europe is just a geographical expression. Whenever people talk about Europe, I assume they're just trying to hide their own selfish national goals. For Metternich, the stuff is serious. Okay? That's the Vienna Summit. What does it tell us about the kinds of issues that we're concerned with? I began by laying out that basic Walt's understanding of what makes for war. The notion is states pursue their own national interests. They can't afford not to. They don't have enough power. They're constantly concerned with how much of a margin of security they have. And they're not going to squander it by pursuing policies that are not in line with their own narrow national interests. And he's very skeptical about all of these notions of, you should look out for the interests of the system as a whole. I'll read you some passages from the Theory of International Politics book, which he makes that skepticism very clear. Okay? This is from page 109 in the Theory of International Politics. It says, structural constraints cannot be wished away, although many fail to understand this. In every age and place, the units of self-help systems, nations, corporations, or whatever, I just say one of the characteristics of the Walt's argument is constantly, since you want to think in systemic terms, it should be an abstract argument that's applicable not just to international politics, but to all systems that have these same characteristics. And he talks about the parallel with economic structures an awful lot in this book. He draws on insights from economics to kind of develop his own theory. Nations, corporations, or whatever, are told that the greater good, along with their own, requires them to act for the sake of the system and not for their own narrowly defined advantage. Right? And he gives a few examples of this. People talked about how the fear of nuclear war should lead countries to general and complete disarmament, and how the threat to the environment should lead countries to put their national interests aside in the interest of the planet as a whole. As is, the argument is always like, the international interest must be served. And if that means anything at all, it means that national interest is subordinate to it. The problems are found at the global level. This is the view of these other people he's criticizing. But solutions to the problems continue to depend on national policies. What are the conditions that would make nations more or less willing to obey the injunctions that are so often laid on them? How can they resolve the tension between pursuing their own interests and acting for the sake of the system? No one has shown how that can be done, although many wring their hands and plead for rational behavior. The very problem, however, is that rational behavior, given structural constraints, does not lead to the wanted results. With each country constrained to take care of itself, no one can take care of the system. It's a tragedy. And this sort of thought recurs constantly in the
waltzing argument. This is from a little bit earlier on, page 91. No state intends to participate in the formation of a structure by which it and others will be constrained. It's impossible. Impossible for states to pursue policies that are not based on their own narrow national interests. It's not just Waltz who makes this kind of argument. Many of you heard of John Mearsheimer? Really? No? No one? Really? Just a few people. John Mearsheimer is, in a sense, he's like the successor to Waltz. He's probably the most influential contemporary international relations theorist, at least one of the two or three top ones, or at least of his generation. And he makes the same sort of argument. See, you know, people have all this rhetoric about the need to worry about the system as a whole, the world as a whole. He says, this rhetoric notwithstanding, great powers do not work together to promote world order for its own sake. Instead, each seeks to maximize its own share of world power, which is likely to clash with the goal of creating and sustaining stable international orders. Yeah. This is not to say that great powers never aim to prevent wars and keep the peace. On the contrary, they work hard to deter wars in which they would be the likely victim. In such cases, however, state behavior is driven largely by narrow calculations about relative power, not by a commitment to build a world order independent of a state's own interests. And he says, the particular international order that obtains at any time is mainly a byproduct of the self-interested behavior of the system's great powers. The configuration of the system, in other words, is the unintended consequence of great power security competition, not the result of states acting together to organize peace. Right? And the book is called The Tragedy of Great Power Politics. Why is it tragic? Because states are trapped. Right? They may, in their hearts, really want to go beyond this kind of system, this anarchic system in which they find themselves, in which everyone is constrained to act selfishly. No one could be concerned with the interests of the system as a whole. But they can't do it. They, you know, to behave in that way, to sacrifice your own interests, means accepting a competitive disadvantage, and security is just too important. You can't do it. Right? Those are their arguments. Hard to imagine how they could be more explicit about this. Right? Now think of the Vienna system. Think of what the whole 1814, 1815 experience, the whole system that it gave rise to, the Concert of Europe. Think of what that implies about that argument. Here are states that are able to do it. They're able to think in terms of the interests of the system. Why do states have an interest in creating a system? See. Remember that Waltz thing that I just read? No state intends to participate in the formation of a structure by which it and others will be constrained? See, that's the fallacy. You can see the fallacy is like embedded in that very sense. The reason I might want to participate in the creation of a system in which my behavior is constrained is precisely that the behavior of others will be constrained as well. That's the benefit that I get, right? And the price that I pay are these limits on my own freedom of action that I may view as a price that's well worth paying, because especially if I'm convinced by this general theory of how goals have to be limited, that overreaching yourself is almost bound to be counterproductive. That the creation of a structure might be in my interest. Right? So if people like Waltz are wrong, does this mean that their opponents, the liberals, are in fact right? The liberals take a very different view from the view taken by people like Metternich and Castlereagh. Woodrow Wilson, who's the archetype of a Western liberal statesman. When he was thinking about peacemaking after the First World War, he referred explicitly to the Congress of Vienna. That, he says, is what we do not want to do.
Right. What did he have against the Congress of Vienna? That the statesmen at Vienna thought in power political terms, that their goal was to create a stable structure of power. For liberals like Woodrow Wilson, that itself is the problem. You can't think in terms of power. You have to think in terms of morality, of justice, you know, of basic principles, ideological principles. Right? So what are the conclusions from all of this? Okay. One important conclusion is that this Waltz argument certainly cannot be taken uncritically. And in fact, one of the amazing things is, if you read what Waltz himself has to say, later in that same book, he takes exactly the opposite argument. This is one of the things that just kind of drives me crazy about this literature. This pages 195 and 198, listen to this. It says, great power gives its possessors a big stake in their system and the ability to act for its sake. So great powers can act on behalf of the system as a whole. For them, management becomes both worthwhile and possible. Right? And he goes on, three pages later. The greater the relative size of a unit, the more it identifies its interests with the interests of the system. Right? Well, it's certainly possible. It makes you wonder about the general theory of what makes for war that lies at the heart, serves as the top of that basic notion about system building being impossible. Okay? What else? Second point is that there's a risk of taking terms like system too literally, as though they kind of exist in a realm of their own over and above the realm of the actual states in question. You're struck when you look at the Vienna period by the fact that it's not just the structure that created these constraints and led to moderate policies and so on. It's the spirit that lay behind those policies. You're struck by the fact that there were people like Metternich who could pursue a policy that looked to the interests of Europe as a whole. I mean, when you think about it, here's Austria that has kind of a built-in rivalry with Prussia for dominance in Germany. And yet Austria plays a key role in transforming Prussia from a state that's kind of half German and half Polish to a state that's predominantly German and which is broken into these two parts, the part in the east and the part in the west, which creates a natural interest for Prussia to dominate at least all of North Germany, maybe all of Germany as a whole. That can't be in Austria's interest, but they're willing to do it anyway because they think that there's a larger interest at stake. Quite extraordinary. And that sort of thing has to have to do with a certain sensibility which is linked to a body of thought that had come into being earlier on. Okay? And the final point, and to my mind the most important point, is that you tend to think of international relations as dominated by these debates between realists and liberals. People like Waltz and Mearsheimer on the one hand, and people that admire Woodrow Wilson. One of the important lessons here is that there is this third tradition, this conservative tradition. It's a realist tradition in a sense because of the role it plays on the importance it attaches to power, but it's not realist in the sense of narrow national interests of the be-all and end-all of policy. This is a tradition, as I say, it goes back to well before the Congress of Vienna period, and it continues beyond the period. We're going to see it coming up again with Lord Salisbury at the end of the 19th century, and then again in the late 20th century with Henry Kissinger, who was the maker of American foreign policy. Oh, this is the 138th. Maker of American foreign policy during the Nixon and Ford administrations. Kissinger wrote his doctoral dissertation, also one of his first books on the Congress of Vienna, World Restored. And the basic concept here, and it's a phrase he uses a number of times in that book, is that absolute security for any one power means absolute insecurity for everyone else. So you can't reach for absolute security if your goal is to create a legitimate international system, because no other state is going to accept the legitimacy of a system in which you have, total control. So you have to pull in your horns. You have to moderate your policies. That's a very different way of looking at international politics. One of the questions that you want to consider is that the answer? Is that the way to go? Okay, next time we're going to talk about the Vienna, concept of Europe period in the early 19th century.